All right. So I'm going to talk about the distributed adaptive control architecture that we have been working on for the last 20 years. And in particular, so I want to give you certainly a general idea of what this architecture is about. But then I'm going to spend also quite some time to show you how I've been doing, how I've been trying to validate the key properties of this architecture to the neural substrates. So this whole exercise of, okay, how do you actually now validate notions of architecture and functional organization with respect to brain and behavior. Then the way I structured this is to provide ingredients for a discussion that we can have about architecture and understanding mind and brain. So that means that there are quite some details I'm going to browse over. But just as, believe me that everything I say is true, so you don't have to worry about the details. Now the point is, if you want to hear details, it's no problem. I have a very good memory for details, so I can share these with you anytime you want. But now I've biased a little bit on sort of the big picture and details. I think we can then better discuss offline or outside of the talk. But again, don't be shy in posing questions about it. Then what I also have done, so to keep it a bit more entertaining, I also have some, let's say, footnotes here and there that are not necessarily on the main narrative of the presentation, but I think bring in some additional aspects that might be interesting for future discussion. All right. Or in other words, the talk is badly structured. Okay, and this is my rationalization of that. Okay, here we go. So first, some general remarks. So if we look at the brain or brains, so my question is a little bit, if you go back to the Cambrian explosion, which is quite a long time ago, then suddenly we had this incredible variety of brains that were generated. Right before the Cambrian, you could think about organisms as being big air mattresses, sort of floating in watery environments. And after the Cambrian explosion, suddenly, in just a few million years, highly sophisticated brains and bodies evolved. So now the question is actually very simple. Were all these brains, or let's put it this, were the brains that have ever existed on this planet and will ever exist in the future based on an underlying set of principles, so the common Bauplan, or are they all based on, let's say, a different set of principles? So I want to believe, and this is the starting point, that whether we talk about, let's say, the mouse or even insects, like here you see the brain of a moth is indicated here to scale. As a starting point of a testable hypothesis, I want to say, well, let's see if we can find one set of underlying principles, right? And let's try to find out what these are. And so that's what this whole DAC architecture is about. Can I find, let's say, a common set of underlying principles of these systems that I can call, if you want, an architecture? Now, in the public domain or in the common sense, there's this idea that goes back to McLean about the triune brain, which would say, like, well, the brain is like this modular system, you know, and you start with, let's say, your reptilian brain, and that's like this well-defined independent module that gives you all these kind of primitive behaviors that you have to inhibit in public. And then you have this next layer that gives you a bit more memory, and then another layer that gives you something that we can call human rationality and ethics and morality, all these things we do show in public, or at least try to. I don't think this proposal is correct. I still think that McLean, he was one of the first to really start to think about this notion of a common architecture. Well, okay, there are already examples in the 19th century of people like Romanes, but I'm not going to talk about him today. As a starting point, and this is also one of the things I would like to convince you of today, is whether we go from the moth to the human, and look here at this cerebellum in the elephant brain, it's completely amazing. It's not just that you stack modules together. Okay, so in that sense, I don't believe in modules as these encapsulated, well-delineated components from which you can sort of construct your own your own brain, like some constructor set. So I don't think that's going to work for us. I know for engineers this might be, let's say, unpleasant and confusing, because of course the world is a lot more controllable and understandable when we can have these well delineated modules we can sort of stick together, and you define some protocol which exchange messages and that's it. Brains, I don't think, have succeeded in solving problems in that way. So the other thing, so this is a figure from a really nice paper by Kubitzer, where I think we can start to become a little bit more specific about this idea of a common Bauplan, a common blueprint, a shared blueprint of brains. And here what Lea is showing is how through, let's say, the phylogeny of mammalian systems, the primary sensory areas have, you know, found their place in a neocortical structure. And her argument is essentially that brains have sort of found a very dynamic way to reconfigure themselves. And I wanted to see how this neocortical sheet is expanding as we go towards humans. But on the other hand, they also have conserved certain properties. It's not that these things were sort of reinvented when we went from platypus to human. So this is interesting. There seems to be some sort of a continuous, this is at least suggestive of some underlying set of principles driving cortical evolution, which Lea unfortunately calls modules, but I won't mention that. All right, now back to our own work. So some definitions. So here, the brain evolved to act. Okay, the brain did not evolve to be transformed in nice colorful pictures in MATLAB. The brain evolved to act. This is the key criterion, because it's only through action that we actually reproduce. And if we are believing Darwin, we do believe the theory of evolution, what matters is reproduction and not colorful pictures. So the brain evolved to act, but to act, you must be embodied. All right, so that means, in my mind, so this is a constraint I impose on my discussion on the brain, it's a mistake to decouple that discussion from action and to decouple it from embodiment. Right? These are very strong constraints of what brains do. So here you see a humanoid robot, they're called iCup robot, and one of my students, Andrea Luvisotto, tries to teach it to play a reduced version of table tennis with varying success. But here we're trying a pretty interesting model of attention. And at the end of the clip, you see all the students only running around the table because the arm pops out of the socket and the robot needed to be repaired for 3 months or something before it worked again. But anyway, you see, here's this panic moment. Because these were all visiting students and they're working with this pretty expensive equipment, so they all felt really bad when this happened, which is an educational moment. But now, so if we talk about the brain and action, I think an important distinction I want to make is the one, and this is a hypothesis that I want to put forward that we can discuss, and I'm happy to be wrong in these hypotheses because I still believe in Popper and I believe that we learn through being wrong. So I don't need to be right, please prove me wrong, that would be great. So I do believe that brains have found, let's say, specializations in order to deal with events and to deal with time. And I will illustrate later what I mean with this. So here we see a mobile robot we developed together with a French robotics company called RoboSoft. It's supposed to be a high mobility outdoor platform. And these images here, and I will explain later what's exactly happening here, are models of the hippocampus that allow us to perform simultaneous localization and mapping on this robot, but then also in GPS denied environments, because you might have realized that goldfish, rats, and also our own brain does not have a GPS. And engineers have been really good in building robots that can navigate using GPS, as in the DARPA challenge. But to have robots navigate without having access to this kind of global information, the way brains do it, is still quite a challenge. Now for the temporal processing, you see a little robot driving around this arena. And it's actually being conditioned to avoid the spatial frequency on the wall. And this is based on the model of the cerebellum. And actually, this model of the cerebellum, I will say a few words about it later, is now also implanted or implemented on a chip that actually right now today is being interfaced to the cerebellum of a living rat, where we will show that this chip is able to replace it, the motor learning capabilities of the cerebellum. So what this also illustrates is that if we think about our models, models of the brain, to get action, I must go to the real world, right? I need embodiment. That's why I'm using robots. As such, robots are a pain to work with because they break, as you see in the iCup. However, it's the only way to get access to the constraints real brains are exposed to. That's the claim, right? On the other end, the neuroprosthetic system shows another example of how you can validate your theories, right? You can actually start to interact with the real brain. You can try to replace circuits in the brain, or you can try to repair the brain. So in the work we do, we are very active also in clinical applications of our models and theories, because I believe that's the second source of validation that we have access to and that we should pursue. All right. So for me, that's also the challenge for the theoreticians among you. If you believe the brain that you know, or you have a hypothesis of how the brain works, you must be able to show that this generalizes into an effective treatment in the clinic. If it doesn't, your theory is just a very rough speculation. Okay? So let's take this as a challenge. Then you can convince me later that this was unreasonable, an unreasonable expectation of theory. So now, what does it mean to act? So for me, for a brain to act, it has to solve what I call the H4W problem. And that's it, nothing else. All right, these are the only things brains have to do to succeed in reproducing. All right, so that means on the one hand, it wants to answer why, what, where, when, which means what are my goals? Which drive am I satisfying? Right, am I hungry? Am I thirsty? Etc. Then what? To what objects in the world does my behavior pertain? To what objects in the world should I relate in order to satisfy my goal? Where am I? Where are these objects? Right? Behavior is organized in space. So I must be able to localize myself in space. I must be able to map space. I must be able to place objects in space. And then when? Time. The world is a dynamic place. Right? The world is unpredictable. So I must, in that sense, shape my actions in time to be effective. All right. So in order to know how to deal with the world, I must answer these four questions. If I talk about the deck architecture, I try to see how I can answer these four questions in my architecture. And the claim is, this is all brains do. All right. So here's an example. We see a rat foraging hoarding in a little environment. This is work performed in Matti Mintz's lab, one of my collaborators in Tel Aviv. And this rat had to learn this environment. And if you look at its behavioral trajectory, like here we have the home base, and here we have the region where it finds food, you'll see that this animal will do very specific things. One of them is that it will go out of the home base, go to the location where it can find the food pellets. If the food pellets are small, it will consume them on the spot. If the food pellets are large, it will first bring them home and consume them there. Okay. But this is roughly the kind of paradigm in the context of which I'm investigating this H4W problem, which essentially is foraging. Which means, how can I master my environment in the service of my own goals? What a distributed adaptive control architecture proposes is that if I want to dissect now this foraging behavior and I want to answer this H4W problem, I should approach that by looking at least at three layers of organization of the brain. And we're going to unpack that later. So the one is a reactive layer, which gives you, let's say, an automatic interaction with the environment. it allows your heart to beat and it allows you to breathe, but also it allows you to, let's say, react to external stimuli in predefined ways. It's a reflex-based system that might control your gaze, your stereotype behavioral patterns to consume food, to defend yourself, etc. Roughly, you could map it onto, let's say, the brainstem and associated structures. Then we have the adaptive layer that does something very specific. The adaptive layer is very much defined in the context of classical conditioning. If you think about Pavlov's dog, you get the idea. But in the parlance of the machine learning people, you could think about this adaptive layer as providing you with the state space of the world and the state space of your own actions, but not in a predefined fashion, right? This state space must be learned. And this is one of my, you know, one of the running discussions I have with the machine learning people, where the argument often goes like, oh, if you allow me to predefine the state space, and if you allow this state space to be discrete, and you allow the world never to change anymore after I define my state space, then I can explain to you how you can learn a behavior or a policy. But that's not what brains have to do. Right? Brains have to answer this H4W problem. So that means the states of the world must be acquired as well while you are learning your policies. Right? So answers that are based on these very strong assumptions, like actually I already know everything and now I'm going to tell you how I can combine things together to give a specific behavior, it's not good enough. Right? And certainly it fails in the real world. If these models are applied to robots, they are not very effective dealing with dynamic environments. We all know that. Right? So what Deck is proposing is that the adaptive layer provides you the basic mechanisms of perceptual and behavioral learning that defines the state space of the world and your own actions with respect to that world. Then at the contextual layer, there we start to use different mechanisms for memory to be able to now exploit the states I have learned. So if you want, you can interpret this as forming plans for action. Right? This is the level at which you start to put these basic elements together so you can actually control navigation, you can make plans for action and deal with complex situations in the world. And the claim is that that's roughly all you need. Well, I would tolerate maybe one more level, which I'm going to show you now. Okay, this is another way to look at a deck, like the boxologist view, but I'm going to fill in these boxes as we go along. So here we have the body, we have sensors and effectors. These are physical transduction systems. Here we have our reactive layer where we have predefined sensor states driving predefined behaviors controlled by an allostatic control system. And I'm going to spend some time explaining to you what I mean with that. Then here at the adaptive layer, we have essentially perceptual systems. We have behavioral systems or action learning systems, and we have internal states that relate more to, let's say, the emotional regulation of balance and arousal in a very minimal view. And then through our memory systems, we interface to the contextual layer where we're dealing with representations of, let's say, sequences of events and actions that we can manipulate dependent on our goals in working memory. And in that sense, they can percolate down again through this hierarchy to drive our skeletal motor system.
Is this motivated by a sort of psychological view of
how things should be, or actual physical adaptation? Well, both. Well, look, this is the summary of where we are after 20 years, right? So how this started was to try to make sense of the psychological and the neuronal aspects of classical operant conditioning, right? So, but the motive, if you want, look, everything that's interesting about the brain to explain is in the realm of psychology. Learning, attention, memory, this is all psychology. It's just that psychologists have done such a bad job of this, and I'm one of them because I'm a psychologist by training, that now we started to call it cognitive neuroscience or something like this, right? But actually, still for me, it's still psychology. Go to William James, you know, this is still psychology. So the phenomena that I want to explain are all in the realm of psychology. But we want to ground this in understanding of the brain, right? We must find this link. This is our challenge, all right? So psychology for me is not a dirty word. This is really the phenomena that we want to explain. And I want to do it with reference to, in reference to the brain. So that's what this architecture tries to capture, all right? And I will give you many examples how we make that link. But now, there's another way to view this architecture. So now we have these horizontal layers I just described to you very quickly, but I also can look at this now in some columnar structure, where I say, like, well, in my blue column here, actually I'm dealing with the external world. I'm dealing with acquiring states or describing states of the external world. So one organizational element of my architecture is completely focusing on the external world. The central column is fully defined by the notion of self. This is fully constrained by my needs, how I regulate my needs, the emotional states I derive from them when my needs collide with sensory states in the world, and the value and utility systems that are built again on my ability to satisfy my needs, with respect to the world and my goals. Okay. So the third column is really the interface between the organism and the world, which is all action, right, the action systems. Another view is one provided by, for instance, Thomas Metzinger in his theory of consciousness, where he is distinguishing, say, three different levels of consciousness. And on the one hand, he would be talking about the weak first-person perspective. And this essentially means that there is a location, if you want, in space, where sensation converges. And in some sense, it is the way you could define an organism, right? It's like also the packaging of sensors that are providing convergent sensory states. So that's what Thomas would call the weak first-person perspective. And then at the second layer, you would have what he calls the minimally phenomenal self. Well, he's a philosopher, so they use all these words that help you win Scrabble very quickly, certainly when you read his larger book on consciousness. But what he means with this is essentially, well, the agent now starts to develop representations of self, representations of the body, without these being phenomenal, without these being experienced explicitly. On the top level, we would have the strong first-person perspective, and this means there's a full-blown phenomenal self where I can say, I'm standing here giving a talk. Okay. So what I try to show with this is that if you think about this deck architecture, there are multiple perspectives you can take at unpacking it, and then the psychological one is another way to do that. So now we get little entertaining footnote, because I'm not going to talk about it any further, but still I want to bring it up for maybe future discussion. So one thing we've done over the last few years is to then translate the principles behind this architecture into a rehabilitation approach for stroke, because the intuition was, look, if this theory makes any sense, and this is a theory essentially about learning, then I must be able to have a positive impact on the brain. So we decided to take stroke as our first target, and we formulated a learning paradigm that exploits virtual reality, task-oriented virtual reality, in order to train stroke patients, to retrain the brain of stroke patients. And this paper that just came out right now is our first study with acute stroke patients, where we show that this method is more effective than intense occupational therapy, which in some sense is one of the standards used right now in the clinic. And what I mean, more effective, as assessed by clinical scales. This has been always a challenge, right? There's been a lot of phenomenological evidence out there where people say, well, something seems to happen when you use virtual reality on these kinds of patients. And then often the challenge, yeah, but now show me that this really translates to changes in the real world for these subjects. And our study is, I think, is definitely the first one that really shows definite positive impact on these clinical scales that have to do with instrumental activities of daily living. So just to say, this is an example of, let's say, the science-based medicine I would like to see that we have now pushed for based on our DAC architecture. And this is work together with Rudiger Zeitz in Düsseldorf, Germany, where we show that the approach we take indeed, in this case, these are healthy subjects. They are viewing the task in this case. They're performing this task. And what is the task? Okay. The task in this case is people have to intercept these spheres. You have to intercept the spheres, like grab them. It's like a variation of your tennis game. Okay. And then there are different levels of complexity. Like first you have to just intercept, then you have to grasp them, then you have to grasp and place them. Okay, but then there are a lot of other things happening, like you customize the difficulty of the game to the performance of the subject and so on. Okay, but the key thing is to show that we also now have found, so we have a functional impact, and now we also have just succeeded in at least finding some neural correlates of why this functional impact would be there, right? Well, for this, DAC makes a number of assumptions. It says, if you want to mobilize learning systems of the brain, you have to consider on the one hand the statistics of the inputs you're generating, but secondly, you have to embed that in the context of goals. Right? So you want to exploit both these aspects of learning. So this is one example of the things we have elaborated, so how we translated these learning principles and how we designed this intervention. Okay. Yeah, upper extremities we look at now. Yeah. So this is completely focusing on acute stroke patients who have problems using their arms and hands. Right. Right now we're also starting to look at other deficits like aphasia and so on, but that's again a different game. Yeah. So back to the robot. So here we have our architecture and a few nervous graduate students because here we're performing a demonstration in one of our European projects of a robot that's now controlled by this DAC architecture. Okay? And this robot is performing a task where it has to, someone shows it a character, a letter, and it then has to move to a certain position in space that is associated in the past with that character. Okay, so how this was done in the past, you would show it a character, like A, it would just perform exploration in space. It hits a certain location that the experimenter has defined as being the location associated with that character, and then the animal or the robot would receive a reward. So it would remember that that position was associated with this character, and we do that for a number of characters, and in this way it can develop it can control its behavior in space. But again, the point is, the way now this robot is navigating in space is controlled by a number of these biomimetic models. Right? It's not controlled by its compass or its GPS. Right? It's really navigating by looking at the world through its camera, by associating visual cues in space with its movements, with its actions, okay? As we would find this in rodents. And then on top of that, it learns certain rules about which characters relate to which behaviors and positions. So it's roughly this example that I'm going to unpack over the coming slides, right? Like how this is achieved. So this is the model behind it. Okay. So here again, we have our three different layers, the DAC architecture. On the one hand, we have an allostatic control system that allows the robot to regulate its behaviors dealing with, let's say, exploration of space or homing. And I will explain this system to you. On top of that, we have a model of entorhinal cortex and hippocampus that I also will explain to you that allows this robot to represent space. Okay. In parallel to this hippocampal stream, we have a neocortical ventral stream that allows this robot to learn representations of the visual environment. And these are mapped into a long-term memory system where it associates visual cues with locations, so it associates the visual cues generated by this ventral stream with locations generated by its hippocampal model relative to its goals, so that now it can be told where to go. Possible actions are then projected onto an approximation of a motor system that, through an interaction with an action selection system that we speculate relates more to basal ganglia, although we have not pursued this one in detail. We've made some progress on the premotor and motor cortex aspects of this architecture. And this now works in real time. This is what's driving the robot behavior. Now, how this model came about is essentially each component of this model was published separately, most of it in the neuroscience literature. This was the game we're playing, as a model of that aspect of the brain. Right? So that means when we published, let's say, our model of the dentate gyrus in Neuron just last year, we don't talk about robots. We just talk about ray tree mapping, because that's one of the phenomena that people have not explained. We're going to talk about it later, right? So we published this model only in reference to the neuroscientific literature, trying to explain specific phenomena. And the same holds for our work on grid cells, or the work on the ventral system, the ventral stream, or prefrontal cortex. It's now that in the context of DAC, we have integrated these elements to now fill in these different boxes you saw in my DAC architecture. All right? So that means that the robot model that you saw, and even though what it does might look simple, we have at least succeeded in convincing our neuroscience colleagues that these models are, let's say, reasonable, that they're not completely violating the current level of understanding of the brain. And this was exactly what we wanted to achieve. Right? So now we've brought them together in the context of real-world behavior. So let's start looking at the reactive behaviors of this robot, the allostatic control system. So here we have Cesar and Andre being on the plaza of our campus, and the robot is sort of happily driving around, and essentially what this robot will be doing, it will be exploring in a self-regulated fashion. So Caesar is not controlling this with his remote control. It is using this exploration phase to pick up visual cues, but then also once in a while it will decide to go home, right? Because it also has a sense for security. And once it goes home, Caesar might show it an exciting picture. So the reactive layer, how does it work? So this is one of the mobile platforms we developed for these experiments. The idea of the synthetic forager, this robot is called a synthetic forager, is essentially to get a robot that can forage like a rodent, but then also really has a 24/7 duty cycle. Right? So you can just put it somewhere and it'll just live in some environment with a continuous duty cycle, also really taking care of its own energy requirements and so on. Okay, this is our objective with this project. And then a robot that is based on our understanding of rodent foraging. Now, the starting point of this reactive control system and this notion of allostatic control that we apply to it goes back to the animal literature. For instance, it has to do with the regulation of stereotype behaviors. You can think about the regulation of defensive behaviors or aggressive behaviors. And in the days that animal studies were still performed in psychology departments, one thing that was revealed, for instance, work here by Blanchard and Blanchard, is how the probability to observe a specific behavior and also the intensity of this behavior will depend very, very much on the distance between an animal, if it's a rodent, and a predator. Okay, so, and this gives the suggestion that the control of these behaviors follow some continuous description of some task space. Right? Dependent on my distance measure to the threatening stimulus, I will vary now the intensity of my response. And others, like Gray, have proposed fairly elaborate structures that or models of the brain that show how different areas along the neuroaxis, really from the brainstem to prefrontal areas, are contributing to this more gradient-like regulation of these stereotype behaviors. So this is also then the starting point that we took here to say, okay, how could I now regulate a set of these stereotype behaviors, switching between different behaviors dependent on my needs, on the requirements that the environment imposes on me or that my body imposes on me, and how can I regulate the intensity of these behaviors dependent on intensity of stimuli in the world? So, as a first starting point, here we have a rat in an open field, and what it's doing is, if you analyze the behavior of a rodent in an open field, it will follow very specific patterns, right? It's not random, right? So initially, it will explore, staying in place, but with time, it will find a wall. You will see it running around the walls for quite some time, tick-mo-tactic behavior, and it's at a certain point in time, again, you will see a switch where it will spend more time in a specific corner in the environment, to which it seems to return regularly. And again, after some time, that corner really has become a fixed location when the animal spends a lot of time, for which it sort of veers out in the environment to explore or to find, to grab food and so on. Okay? So behavior is indeed highly regulated, following very specific patterns. And this is what we want to capture in our model. So what we started out with is the concept of what we call a gradient field, which basically means I have a certain function that describes, let's say, an attractor landscape in the environment. And basically it tells me, look, I have a big, if this is my security gradient, I would have a big attractor in the corner, which is my home base. This is a place where I like to be, so the probability to find me in this location is high. And essentially, all I need to do now is I have this field is defined in some sense, so I have a desired value, which might mean, look, I want my security to be high, and now I just have to measure a differential in this field. I have to measure the gradient, so this can tell me whether I'm closer or further away from my home base. So this is a fairly straightforward way to think about this kind of behavior regulation, going back to Cannon, 1930s, where you would think about homeostatic control. But it doesn't solve the whole problem, because I must be able to regulate multiple subsystems of these, right? And for instance, at some point in time, my need for security can be high, so I want to be home, but sitting in the home base for long enough and having watched TV for many hours, I'm getting hungry. So you must be able to switch. You cannot work with predefined priorities between these homeostatic subsystems. So, and that's then where this notion of allostatic control comes in, where I said, look, I might have such a gradient defined for exploration that I might link to a notion of arousal, which will make me go out in the environment to find new things, to find information, to find food, to find mates. But I must be able to switch between these two. Now, in physiology, this notion of allostatic control has been used to describe, if you want, a meta-level control over homeostatic subsystems, which allow you to control, let's say, thresholds, gains, time constants of homeostatic subsystems. And this is our proposal, that the regulation of these behavioral systems depends on this allostatic control, where by changing thresholds and gains, I can also, dependent on my needs, I can now decide to go explore, find food, or stay home to protect myself from predators. Okay. So then we went out to test this model. So let's see what this would look like for a robot. So imagine I have an environment, which is delineated here, and in these plots I show the probability to find a robot in a certain position in space. If I now regulate the security and the arousal systems of this robot, then if the need for security is low but arousal is high, I should see pure exploration. However, if on the other hand arousal is low, I might see implicit homing behavior. That means I stay away from the center. I tend to go more towards the walls in the environment. While if my arousal is low and my need for security high, I'm going home. All right. So now how did we test this model? So on the one hand, you saw that, okay, earlier you see the robot driving around, it can explore, it can go home, and so on. This is one way to test it. But also then we started to map this on rodent behavior and physiological measures of security and arousal, which I will show you some examples of. So first, a little generalization. Here we show that we can generalize this model to behavior of rodents in a Y maze. So this is a maze that we work on together with Cyril Penaerts in Amsterdam. So Cyril built a really interesting maze set up for rodents where he has different holes where the animal can get a food reward, and the animal has to go to the specific port where an LED comes on. So that's a signal that tells the animal that it can expect a reward. And then what Cyril is looking at is how different cues, how the response of the animal to different cues and orders of cues affects their behavior. And what we do here, so we built a mixed reality setup to test our robot. So this is the Y maze, our robot drives around, and this sort of psychedelic pattern you see in the center is then the different gradients that this robot is exploiting to find its way in the maze. All right, so on the one hand, and I will expand this again a little bit later, because there's a deep assumption hidden behind this we have to account for. So that means we can scale this up to fairly complex foraging behavior of rodents, but still, is there any biological validity to this notion? Well, what we did for this, now we know that if I look at behavior, if I look at the position of the robot in space, I can map this back to its states of arousal and security, right? Because it's these internal states that actually will control its behavior. So we've done the same thing now with the trajectories of rats. So we've taken rats, we've taken their trajectory, played them through our model, and now we have predicted the levels of security and arousal that the animal hypothetically could experience. Now, what we then looked for is, okay, is there any way in which I can find some physiological correlate of any of these two state variables? So we looked at arousal. Arousal, you can map to heart rate, in particular heart rate variability. So what we have done, we take an animal, it freely moves in space, okay? And then we made two conditions. This is work we've done together with Mavi Sanchez at IDIBABS, same institute where Albert is. So what Mavi has done in this experiment is after the animal had familiarized itself with the environment, it put it in a plexiglass cylinder, as you can see here, and placed the animal in the cylinder in the center of the environment or in the corner. Okay? And the prediction would now be, given the model we have developed, that in the corner we should see a different measure for the heart rate variability, actually a higher measure for heart rate variability, because there should be a lower heart rate because we expect lower arousal. And this also turns out to be the case. With that, the story is not finished. Of course, you would like to find, let's say, a neuronal correlate now of the security and arousal measures, and that's what we're pursuing right now. However, so far, this whole notion of these stereotype behaviors that define the reactive layer of control for my organism as being controlled by these more gradient-like representations of behavior in space seems to map onto, let's say, the very specific view on arousal and heart rate variability that we do have access to. Okay, so there's some plausibility to this notion of the decomposition of stereotype behaviors along this notion of homeostatic subsystems controlled by an allostatic controller. One problem is, of course, that, let me see if I have a illustration for this. And I'm sure you were all very worried about this, because now your challenge will be, well, that's all nice and well, but again, also here, you are predefining these states, you are predefining these gradients, and in some sense, you cannot fail if you take that kind of liberty, right? If you take the liberty to define these gradients any way you want, then of course you can account for any kind of behavioral pattern. This is not a big surprise. And yes, that's true. So what we're doing here, and I'm going to show you some of these results a bit later, because this pertains to this what I call adaptive layer, I'm going to show how we can generate these gradient-like representations of space relying on the kinds of representations of space the hippocampus generates. That's one. Yes, please. Mm-hmm. It's sort of anti-correlated with the heart rate. That's our physiological data that we correlate with the behavior. Okay, remember that we say, well, exploration depends on arousal. So arousal has to be high for me to go out in the environment. Right, and arousal has to be low for me to go home. Okay, this was our assumption. And physiologically, you can map arousal to heart rate, to properties of the heart rate. Right, so our prediction now was, okay, if this model is true, and if arousal is controlling my exploration versus homing behavior, I must find a correlate of this in the heart rate.
Is there any number of models?
That's fine. Unfortunately, they were not existing in the literature yet. Okay?
The idea is you can make up a model that, you know, you don't necessarily have to be using these sort of gradient techniques. I mean, so this is just one instantiation that will give you that type of different behavior. Is that kind of what you're getting at? Yeah. I mean, it's sure, it may not exist in the literature, but just saying, it's not necessarily predicting this is the exact thing, that this is what's really going on. It's saying that what you did here is consistent with what you see, which is fine.
Yeah, but I don't see the problem of that.
There isn't a real problem with it. It's just
it's a good match.
No, but wait, either it's a very generic question around the issue of what's a model and what makes a model valid, right? This can be one kind of question. And then the other kind of question, what makes a specific model valid or invalid, right? So what I showed you here is that we have decomposed, also on behavioral grounds, this reactive control of behaviors as being based on these gradients, going back to this Blanchard and Blanchard data, which already is a strong statement, right? Because you say it's not like some discrete kind of action control, right? Behavior is more organized in a continuous space of possible actions. That's a pretty strong statement. Right, and other approaches for reactive control, certainly the domain of, let's say, behavior-based robotics and so on, have not taken that approach. Right, they're more based on, let's say, discrete solutions, except some work on, let's say, force field control for robot obstacle avoidance, going back to the 80s. So there's some interest in, but there the problem was that people couldn't solve the problem of local minima. Okay, that's Khatib and other people. That's the only example you will find in the robotics literature that deals with, say, more of a continuous control of behavior. What we've shown here is that we can account for the regulation of behavior at this reactive level in relation to this physiological notion of allostatic control. Because this is the big challenge, right? The question is not how can I control one kind of behavior, but how can I do this dynamically and flexibly in unpredictable environments? And for that now, we bring in this notion of allostatic control. Right. This is another testable prediction, because we're saying, well, you can dynamically change gains and time constants and thresholds. Right? And this pertains also to this theory of gray that I referred to earlier. Right? Now we try to come to a prediction we can test. Okay? Well, we are regulating behavior, and we say behavior is controlled by internal states of the animal. And one of the internal states we called arousal. So we just posed a very simple question, how do we make this testable? How do we make arousal testable, physiologically, right? And then we went to heart rate, because that's the standard way, right? So if you challenge me and say, well, I could do this with any other model, So how long are you going to stay here?
No,
tell me, how long are you going to stay here?
Until the 6th.
Okay, then on the 5th, you give me another model that has the same robustness as this one. And I think you will have a hard time.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Exactly, but still, earlier you said rather loosely.
My point in that was this is not, this is a choice, this is a design choice that you make.
Yeah, but then you're really debating more a generic, let's say, issue around what makes a model and how do you choose a model, right?
It's all.
Sorry?
How do
I show it wrong?
How would you show it?
Well, for instance, my heart rate measure could have come out completely differently. A priori, I did not know. Right? This is a testable prediction that heart rate would show me some sort of also continuous variation in space. Right? As predicted by this model. Nobody knew this. There was no literature on that. This was our prediction. We tested it and we found it. And that's what I give to you now as a present. And then you say, oh, but that's predictable. Well, then you should have told me that 2 years ago. I should have done, then I wouldn't have to go through all this work. Right?
So it's interesting. I mean, it's sort of like a structural equation model. I'm showing you one that works. That doesn't mean it's exclusive.
That's,
I mean, I think that's the point. But I think with coming from the top-down point of view, I just want to make sure I have it. You've kind of said, I want to study this system. I'm using that Blanchard.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. I'm looking to see whether or not at this allostatic, homeostatic, subsystem model, there's a parsimonious solution where I can accommodate that curve,
mm-hmm.
that continuous curve, and I'm going to use heart rate as my behavioral readout. Could have been
my testable prediction, yes.
Testable, mm-hmm. not be exclusive. I mean, we were just joking about the fact that, you know, you can, you know, whether or not you go to home or you go to explore, it all depends on what's at home. And that gets into, as Dr. Barber said that.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, I just wanted to know, is when you're constructing these models, is it always best to actually start at this lowest level and build up? Because you would predict that you would find these conceptions at your conceptual, the top level.
Uh-huh.
There's so many exceptions, you can't model anything. Whereas actually seeing you build it from the bottom, you haven't seen where it falls apart yet, but at least you have predictability as you're going from the base coming up.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, if I get what you're saying, it's also an issue of how do I put constraints on a model, right? How do I make a model plausible? And why would one model be more plausible than another model? Like, why is my model more plausible than your hypothetical model that you will give me on August 5th, right? No, I'm going to come back to you. So the point is that that's all a matter of constraints, right? What kind of constraints am I imposing on my model, right? So in this case, as constraint, I'm imposing behavior, right? We looked at behavior, we take regularities from behavior, that's the Blanchard data. I take real time, I have a real time robot being controlled by this system that also, and then I have a physiological measure in addition, because I make a prediction on heart rate that I validate. Okay, so I have imposed a number of constraints on this model that come from different levels of description. And I'm trying to show how behavior and substrate do relate. Okay, and I think, you know, a model in the end is just a curve fitting exercise, right? You have a data space, a cloud of data, to which you want to fit a curve. And mathematically, there's an infinite number of curves you can fit. That's a bit your argument. So that means to solve this problem of indeterminacy, as it's called, you have to impose constraints on your curve fitting procedure. And if you talk about mind, brain, and behavior, then these constraints, in my mind, have to come from different levels of description you can relate to, which in the case of the brain is physiology, anatomy, and behavior. These are your constraints. And you have to show that your model can satisfy as many constraints as possible, and then that model is more plausible than its candidates. However, this doesn't imply that your model is a unique solution. You can never be sure about that. It's just the best approximation at that point in time. So therefore, I claim that what I showed you now is a better approximation to account for these phenomena than the model you will show me on August 5th, right? So this is how I look at modeling. So modeling, as that sense, is not about truth. Truth is for logic and mathematics, right? But not in this business. Yes, please. In the cylinder. Yeah.
So the mouse, how is it chosen that the mouse uses the lower right hand corner as its own?
Well, what we did, and this is sort of roughly depicted here, the animal would run around in space, and you know behaviorally that it always will take a corner as the home base, right? So the probability that it will feel more, let's say, secure in a corner is higher than in the center. And then, basically, we looked at the distribution of heart rate in space, right? And also we looked at the probability to find the animal in a certain position. And the area where we found the animal with the highest probability, which was a corner, we then defined as, okay, this is the home base where we're going to measure heart rate in the plastic glass cylinder. Okay, and the prediction was, okay, this is where we should find a heart rate signature that is correlating with low arousal. That was the prediction.
The point of plastic glass cylinder is so that we cannot account for increased heart rate by faster.
Yeah, also that it cannot escape, right? So in that sense, that I can at least have sufficient time to measure the heart rate to also reliably assess variability, so that I don't leave it just up to the animal whether it stays in a certain position, but I can really control it. And in some sense, of course, constraining behavior will actually increase arousal. So it is a manipulation that's against our prediction. Yeah.
So again, one thing that seems to me to be really important about this in the context of our earlier discussions on multi-scale panel is the idea that you're really taking constraints from very different ends. You're taking a bottom-up hypothesis about the actual structure of the implementation of the controller. And then you're taking a sort of top-down picture, which is very behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I think what's important about that is that top-down and bottom-up set of constraints. And it doesn't uniquely necessarily determine things, but trying to pull both of those in is really crucial and mechanistic for that internal mechanistic, and of course, I presume there's a lot more you can do if you have more measurements of what's going on inside the reference.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you can, this underlying causal mechanism, I think it's really important as a you know, modeling. I think that's something we should put on the stack of things to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't want to spend a lot of time now, but I think that's an important issue, and I think this is a great example of it. So I'd like to talk about that more.
Right. No, sure. And I would agree with that, right? Sorry. Yeah.
It was a point to where you come up with protocols, where you brought up the two layers. We have behavioral
strictly,
and then, can you play around with how they talk to each other? You have a gradient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some kind of protocol that says how that's done. So we need to search that space.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I can show an example of that, right? Because then that was to scale this up. Let me see. Do I have it? Oh, no, wait. That was something else. I'll have an example of it later, how we scale this up. Because this is, again, another footnote, but I would love to discuss it. So my claim is that this whole idea of gradient-based behavior, I think, goes back to bacteria. And, I mean, we know it goes back to bacteria. And my claim is that actually the brain has capitalized on that trick of bacteria, but now it just internalized it. That the brain is exploiting internally constructed gradients and gradient ascent and gradient descent as bacteria already exploited very effectively much beyond brains existed. And that's what I call this notion of affordance gradients really going from E. coli to humans. This is one story that I'm trying to develop that I'm very enthusiastic about. And why do I have all this confidence about that? Is that's because we also do a lot of work on insects. And this is again a footnote, just to entertain you a little bit. So we've done a lot of work on to test these ideas about reactive control, looking at insects, because insects are very much predefined animals in their behaviors. Of course, we know bees are amazing, they can learn and so on, but many of their behaviors are predefined, right? So what we looked at on the one hand is, let's say, the flight control systems of flying insects. In particular, this here you see the processing stream to the lobular giant movement detector of the locust brain, which is a wide field neuron that takes inputs from basically all the photoreceptors that it has, and it detects looming stimuli. And it's also used for, let's say, a distance regulation when locusts are migrating in swarms. And here you see a flying robot whose optomotor behavior is also fully controlled by this model, by this reactive controller. And actually it's doing something funny. It's like avoiding the red tiles that you see at the edges, and it tries to land on the green tiles because that's the target. So we use this, again, biologically constrained model of the optomotor system to control real-time behavior of our robot. And the behavioral constraint, again, is flying moth or a flying insect. So we have behavior that we try to account for in these mechanistic terms. And we have combined this also with the chemical sensing system. And we have done a lot of work on chemical sensing and also more, let's say, taxis or chemotaxis and how, and this is really unique in insects, and also you see traces of this in humans, that if you look at chemical sensing and chemotaxis, chemical search behavior, the male moth is a very strange solution to this chemical sensing problem, because it flies around with this massive antenna on its head, which are not very aerodynamic, but it has incredible sensitivity to, for instance, the pheromones that female moths release, because the female moth is only releasing these pheromones at homeopathic quantities. So you must be really highly sensible or sensitive to pick that up. But in order to be successful in localizing this female, the mate, it combines this exquisite sensing capabilities with very specific behavioral properties, which is also called cast and search. And you see it a little bit in this trace here of this moth, that you see it flying upwind. Here's a female moth. The wind direction is going there. You see that certain parts of trajectories are fairly straight, and others it is sort of casting against the wind direction. And this is triggered by the presence or absence of pheromone. Okay, so also this behavior we conceptualize, we try to understand and interpret from this perspective, this regulation of these behavioral gradients. And there's another paper that I would like to point out to, because this is something that came up on Monday. It is this specific neuron that entered the literature in Science and Nature as being the first neuron discovered in nature that can multiply. And I was very concerned with that, because I don't want to believe neurons can locally perform multiplications. So it is in this PLOS paper where we show that you can account for the nonlinear output properties of this neuron by taking into account the whole processing stream. So you might have nonlinear properties in these circuits, but it's really emergent out of all the different layers of computation that take place, or processing that take place, and it's not localized in one neuron. And I like flying robots because with flying robots, lots of stuff can go wrong. And if it goes wrong, it's often pretty expensive. And I think it's a very good way to test your models. So flying robots are cool. Okay, now adaptive layer, right? We have two more layers to go.
Mm-hmm. So here it's a flying robot that I'm flying like off the ground. So in terms of, like, if you were, if this were plausible in biology, the solution that would come up one is you have tooling using robots to join the icon. What it is about the actual hardware that constrains or determines why this is a good solution or not.
Right. Yeah, no, this is a good point. And there's actually a big discussion around this whole issue of embodiment, right? How embodiment really impacts on also cognition and perception and action and so on, right? So this is a very relevant debate. And for instance, what I can prove to you is why evolution did not give rise to quadcopters. Okay, that I can give you a full account of, because in chemical search, you know, there's no symmetry to how these chemicals distribute themselves through the medium, right? So that means if you want to move towards the source, you have to always move against the wind direction or the flow of some medium, right? And that means if I'm a quadcopter, I'll be disturbing that distribution dramatically, right? So it makes good sense for this male moth to have this big antenna in the front, because this really allows it to assess the distribution of whatever volatile it's interested in space. Okay, so and this is definitely an example, at least in my mind, of how the specific, also physical realization of this animal is contributing to it solving this problem so effectively. And this is a very simple example. It's actually a huge debate, which I think we should also put on the stack, because you know, there's always this idea like, okay, you have the body, but going back to our Christian tradition, sort of the body at best gives you all these bad things, you know, the bodies are dirty and so on. So in the end, all this magic happens in this central controller we call the brain. So that would mean that all the control loops are really local to a brain and not necessarily mediated or modulated by embodiment. And I think there's a lot of evidence now that has been a pretty naive view, actually. And also we have contributed to that with one of our papers where we show, which I will not discuss today, but we can talk about it later, where we show that really the habits we form in life very much define an effective space of interaction, and that as such will affect the input sampling of a world and thus impose a bias on our perceptual systems. So now this would be an example of a pure behavioral non-neuronal feedback loop that is still constraining how a perceptual substrate would organize itself, right? So yes, this is a very important class of questions to which, okay, we have some limited insights. And we definitely lack a coherent theory, let's say, to bring these different components together in a consistent fashion. It's not clear at all how you can do that. Huh? Okay, adaptive layer. So the adaptive layer, remember, I'm looking at this adaptive layer very much from the perspective of states, right? That if I want to act in a world that's unpredictable, partially knowable, and so on, I have to acquire my representations of that world and the states it can attain, but also I must know my own states. Why can't you not predefine this? Well, there's incredible variability among body plans, right? Even though we are all human, in terms of the details of our body, there's quite some variability. So it's not that I can just predefine also the states that define my actions like that. So if I talk about acquiring these states, it's not only with respect to sensation, it's also with respect to action. Now the adaptive layer, already a long time ago, we were struggling with this whole issue of, okay, if I have these predefined sensory action relationships, I have, let's say, predefined stimuli like shocks, you know, or air puffs or painful events, these will automatically trigger action, okay? But if I think about classical conditioning, which was my starting paradigm, I can use these reactive control loops, the occurrence of a painful stimulus and the action that it is triggering, I can use this as a cue for learning, right? Because actually it tells me, okay, something meaningful happened. So now I want to learn about the states of the world that are predictive of the occurrence of this predefined stimulus, and that you can call a conditioned stimulus. And then what we were worried about is, okay, how can I do this using learning rules, learning systems that at least are defendable from a neural perspective? That means where every synapse can only rely on local information to change its properties, right? So not using some global error signal that is triggered by magic. And essentially, what this gave rise to was a learning model that very directly implements the Rescola and Wagner laws of associative competition. These go back to 1972. And what Rescola and Wagner were worried about is how can learning systems that play a role in classical conditioning deal with, let's say, conflicting information? Or under what conditions do you actually learn about multiple stimuli? And the bottom line of their laws of associative competition was that animals only learn when events violate their expectations. And you might be aware that right now in literature there's a big interest in prediction and expectation, but in the domain of animal learning and psychology, this certainly goes back to Rescola and Wagner, if not others, who already captured this at the behavioral level. Okay, so then what we've done subsequently is we show this is work with Armin Duf in my group. We have elaborated this further, and we have shown that, and now I just want to give you the key concepts. Then I'm going to show you how we think about these at the neuronal level. Okay? So what we've shown more recently is that you can formally understand that adaptive layer learning system that does classical conditioning, it's learning associations between neutral stimuli and stimuli that have an intrinsic value, like food shocks. It does that by actually optimizing three objectives, right? On the one hand, it is the correlation between these events. On the other hand, it is a perceptual prediction. You want to be able to predict this conditioned stimulus given what we call your internal state, right? So if you are, let's say, being aversively conditioned, so the food shock triggers an aversive state. This modulates learning, so now you can associate some tone to the aversive state and the associated action. It does that by optimizing perceptual predictions. But in addition, you want to optimize the actions that you're generating, right? So our prediction there was, from this analysis, that this adaptive layer, in order to acquire the state space of sensation and action, is also optimizing its behavioral predictions. And then with that, the question became, okay, but how does the brain then do that? If we claim that I'm optimizing perceptual predictions on the one hand and behavioral prediction on the other, what's the neural substrate of that? So here you see an example of this model applied to a simulated robot that has to make decisions with respect to these colored cues. So here there's a reward. Here we have the different colors, and the robot is required to sort of associate actions with these different cues. And here you see the kinds of trajectories you would get when only perceptual learning is turned on, okay, or when perceptual and behavioral learning is turned on continuously, or when the behavioral learning is only turned on after initial phase of perceptual learning. So what it shows intuitively, that the way you balance perceptual and behavioral learning has quite an impact on your performance, at least in this model. So here we show how we use zeta here as a way to balance these two learning systems, so the contribution of behavioral and perceptual learning to overall performance. And here we have a performance measure, and a normalized performance measure, and you see that dependent on how you control this balance between these two forms of learning, performance will vary. And in the end, what you would like to see is a dynamic regulation of the balance between perceptual and behavioral learning, dependent on your performance. In other words, if you know your states, your perceptual state space, you want to freeze perceptual learning and just worry about acquiring your actions, right? On the other hand, when the world changes, you want to be able to again engage your perceptual learning system to acquire these new states. Okay. So that's now the general intuition we want to test at the neuronal level. And for that, we went to the details of classical conditioning. So it's illustrated here with some figures from not that recent review paper, but I think they're still very instructive. So classical conditioning, which was the key paradigm which we tested this adaptive layer, has been mapped since the late 80s, actually fairly unambiguously, to two key structures in the brain. So the one end, the amygdala, and the other end, the cerebellum. So, and what people have observed is that the amygdala plays a very essential role in, let's say, the early components of classical conditioning, where essentially you will be learning to change your heart rate, your autonomic responses to stimuli, very rapidly. So, and the amygdala, and this is a very important aspect of it, is not only controlling these downstream systems of autonomic responses, it is also controlling systems that directly control learning at the cortical level. And in particular, the nucleus basalis of Meynert, where you will find populations of GABAergic inhibitory and cholinergic modulatory neurons that project rather diffusely into the cerebral cortex. And I will show you an example of that, what that means. On the other hand, at level of the cerebellum, you know, look, if you lesion the amygdala, right, then what you will see is that this autonomic learning phase will be compromised. Okay? But under some conditions, the motor learning itself, like for instance an eyelid closure in eyeblink conditioning, can still be acquired. So that showed this dissociation between these two learning systems. And what we know about the cerebellum, and we're going to look at a bit more detail of that, is that the cerebellum is critically involved in learning the amplitude time course of the response. So what we are proposing here, what we're going to test now, is that to acquire my state space for of states of the world that are predictive of events such as rewards and punishments, I rely on my amygdala, while to fine-tune my state space of action, I rely on my cerebellum. The amygdala cortical system will do this by optimizing perceptual predictions, right? That's what we would claim, that's what we claimed earlier, while the cerebellum does that by optimizing behavioral predictions. And now I'm going to show you why I believe this is indeed the case. So on the amygdala cortical system, I'll be fairly fast. So on the one hand, there's a lot of work, but also going back to Weinberg in late 80s, and then Mike Mertzenich and others, there have been many examples of this. So here we look at the primary auditory cortex of a rodent. We look here at the distribution of the frequency representation in this area. So these are just sort of temporal areas. You can go in with your electrode, you present different tones to the animal, you measure the response, and then you make a colorful picture that shows how these different frequencies are distributed in cortex, and you will find some sort of tonotopic organization. But now, if you take any of these frequencies, in this case it was 8 kilohertz, and you present that together with a noxious stimulus, or with stimulation of this nucleus basalis of Meynert I mentioned earlier, you see dramatic reorganizations of these maps, as illustrated here. So suddenly the cortex, the neocortex, allocates a lot more neurons to that particular frequency that was reinforced. So the way I represent states of the world now is changing, dependent on their contingencies with other stimuli. I do not lose my specificity to other frequencies. However, I sort of reshuffle their weight, if you want. Now I'm going to say, look, this frequency is really important for me, and the other ones are maybe of less significant. The model we proposed does the following. We have a model of excitatory neurons in the cortex. Every neuron receives inputs from the thalamus, the auditory part of the thalamus, that form its receptive field, that have some sort of tuning envelope with plastic synapses, that would be here at 4. All these neurons are recurrently coupled with an inhibitory population of neurons, and the learning rule essentially relies on this notion of backpropagating action potential. So this was a discovery from the early 90s or mid-90s, more or less, that people like Sackmann and others observed that when neurons spike, it's not only that the action potential travels down the axon, but also travels backward into the dendrite, right? And then there was additional work that showed that these backpropagating action potentials played an important role in modulating synaptic plasticity. Larry Abbott and others have done quite some work on that at the time. In our model, what we now show is that if I assume a shunting inhibition, recurrent inhibition onto the dendrite, that does not necessarily inhibit the action potentials the neuron generates, but it shunts the backpropagating action potential, I get a very interesting competitive learning system, right? Because, okay, if I spike early in this game and I drive this inhibition, in principle, my backpropagating action potential will still escape the shunting inhibition. While if I spike late in this game, then the shunting inhibition will prevent me from triggering any kind of plasticity in my dendrite. So what this gives rise to is a dynamic recruitment in my population. Because if my receptive field is close to the stimulus, then my latency of response will be short, and I can learn. But it also means if anyone in a network is learning, my dendrite is being shunted. I will not learn. Right? So I get a dynamic recruitment of these receptive fields across my population, which you can now interpret in terms of prediction. Because if any neuron is predicting the stimulus correctly, it will spike early. Okay, so it becomes a predictive learning system exploiting this notion of backpropagating action potentials and shunting inhibition. And here you see our simulation of this setup. We've done this on many different forms, also with real-time data and so on, music and God knows what. So here we have the naive system. We see some sort of tonotopic organization of its frequency tuning. We take the blue frequency and we pair that with an unconditioned stimulus, a painful stimulus. That essentially means that now the inhibition, remember I told you earlier that the nucleus basalis of Meynert, which is triggered by the amygdala, so there's a painful stimulus, the amygdala detects it very early, drives the nucleus basalis, which releases acetylcholine in the cortex and also GABA, and the GABA mainly targets the inhibitory interneurons in the cortex. So that's exactly what happens in our model. I have my unconditioned stimulus. It inhibits, the projections from the basal forebrain inhibit the shunting inhibition. So now you see what happens, right? I open the learning window again for all the neurons in the network. Because the competitive recruitment is now suppressed, any neuron that is close to this input stimulus can start to tune its receptive field to it. So with that, we can account for exactly the kind of reorganization of the auditory representation A1 that Mike Mertznik reported. For the cerebellum, so then the testable prediction here was actually, we assumed in this model, and at the time we didn't notice whether this was true, what we needed for this model to work was inhibition of the interneurons in our cortical network. So far, the literature had only emphasized the cholinergic modulation of learning in the cortex. And acetylcholine is mainly having an effect on the dendrites and the potassium, the outward potassium currents. It regulates the outward currents in the dendrite by mainly closing the potassium outward current, so it makes dendrites more sensitive, or it changes the length constant, as you could call it, as it is called, actually. And others have a direct effect, or the cholinergic system also can have a direct effect on plasticity through the NMDA system itself. So that seemed to be a contradiction, because we were talking about inhibiting the inhibition. But later, so this was our testable prediction, and indeed we found out then later that the nucleus basalis of Meynert also has GABAergic neurons that specifically target the interneurons in the cortex. So again, we had a prediction we could test. Yes?
The GABAergic neurons in the basal protein do not project the cortex.
Well, that's not what Mike Mercinick told me.
Well, he's wrong.
He's wrong. That's good then. All right.
Because, there is some long distance inhibition in the rat, but in the primate system, we have never seen.
No, but I'm talking about rodents in this case, right?
No, I know, but even in the
Mm-hmm. Where do they project then? They stay local to the nucleus basalis.
So, that's what we were talking about the other day, that the cortex has this different inhibitory system.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yes, exactly. We should look into that, because of course in my case for this model you would still say this amygdala that's very rapidly detecting your noxious stimulus is regulating learning at this cortical level, right? So this is yes, absolutely, sure.
And in fact, a lot of the projections from these areas that signal the values,
right, exactly.
Go specifically to a group of inhibitory neurons in the amygdala called the interconnected neurons,
yes,
which have a very strong impact on the internal processing in the amygdala.
Really? Oh, that's nice. Okay. So your prediction would be that if I want to survive with this, I should try to link it to these cortical inhibitory systems. So then the prediction would be amygdala drives these cortical inhibitory systems to regulate this. This is the key concept I should try to validate then.
Yes,
right.
So in other words, if you don't have this alarm state,
Right. Very good. So you should explain this to me later, please.
Okay.
It'll be very nice. Thank you. Great. All right. So I was wrong, but you know, we're gonna recover from that. Cerebellum. So the point is that So this is the exercise we went through again, right? We tried to map these more abstract notions of perceptual prediction to the neural substrate. And this is how we did it, through a second level of modeling that really tries to link these functional notions to the substrate. And the same thing we've done for the tuning to the action space. So the cerebellum is really cool structure in the sense that half the neurons in your brain are in the cerebellum. And then the input and output structures of the cerebellum are very well defined. And that has made it a target for theoretical studies very early on by Marr and Albus, for instance. Now, what is characteristic of the cerebellum is sort of illustrated here. This I got from Gary Heslow, one of our collaborators. And Gary does amazing work with recordings from single Purkinje cells in the decerebrated ferret. And so the Purkinje cell, which sits here in the circuit, so here we have our tone coming in, or our tone representation that is sort of modulated by the cortex. Here you have your shock coming in over the inferior olive. And if you look at what the Purkinje cell does after training, so initially it will just spike at some basic level, a baseline level, but then with time and learning you will see that it starts to show a pause in its spiking. Okay? So that's the characteristic signal that is associated with learning at the level of the cerebellum. And why does the Purkinje cell pause? Well, the output of the Purkinje cell is inhibitory onto the deep nucleus, And a deep nucleus is projecting to the motor nuclei of the brainstem that is generating then the conditioned response or the eye blinks. So what we are interested in understanding is, okay, so here we have now our conditioned stimulus coming in. It's okay, there's a tone. What we then have shown is that why you expand these representations is also that in some sense you increase the amplitude of the response at this level. So you start to enter in this way this cerebellar learning system. But the thing we were particularly interested in is, okay, how does this loop here exactly work? And why is that interesting? Well, here, if I may infer, Olive, the unconditioned stimulus, so the pain, the foot shock, the what have you, comes in here, drives the inferior olive, that is driving the climbing fibers that make excitatory synapses with single Purkinje cells. So they're very specific in their projections, while the parallel fibers that come from the granule cells that receive input from the muscle fibers originating in the pons actually make very diffuse connections in the cerebellar cortex. So the site of learning is the Purkinje cell, but why is this Purkinje cell now generating an inhibitory projection? Inhibition is in red here, an inhibitory projection onto the inferior olive, right? So, okay, here it is. So essentially what we showed is that the Purkinje cell is trying to make an estimate or a prediction on the occurrence of this noxious stimulus. So it tries to time this pause relative to the occurrence of the noxious stimulus, right? So that it can make sure you close your eyes by the time you get the air puff. The negative feedback here essentially means, okay, that this circuit here is predicting the occurrence of the teaching signal, or the error signal as it is called, that is percolating through the inferior olive and ends up at the Purkinje cell. So the Purkinje cell is trying to predict when this error signal occurs. And if it predicts correctly, it will prevent this error signal from arriving at the level of the Purkinje cell, the site of learning, so that now we have, let's say, a negative feedback control on your own teaching signal. Okay. So I'm showing a little bit of data on that in the next slide, so simulation data. But the key thing to see here now is that we took these notions of perceptual and behavioral prediction that we believe to be valid given the robot studies we had done in the context of behavior, and now we've tried to map them in this second generation of models that take more of the physiology and anatomy into account. Some may be incorrect, but we will improve that, to try to now relate these higher level functional concepts to the neural substrate. So here we have an implementation that we believe is a way you can think about prediction at the cortical level for perception. And here is a direct implementation of motor prediction as implemented in this negative feedback loop in the cerebellum, which essentially we believe is also then the neural substrate of the Ruskola and Wagner laws of stimulus competition. Yeah.
I wonder if so the hour's getting late.
Mm-hmm.
My brain's corrupting in this block. So I wonder if you could sort of wrap up the middle level.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Maybe start a half hour early for us and just run into the higher
thing.
So we come back to the rest and
sure, your choice.
A lot of detail here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, look, to finish up the adaptive layer. Oh no, we're halfway with that. Look, your choice. I mean, like I said, it's all true. So in that sense, you don't have to worry about the details. But of course, I'm happy to wake up early and start talking at 7 about this. No problem. Okay. Uh-huh. So what we'll do then is, so what I've left is essentially here I map these notions of prediction to a neural substrate, right? Then what I have to explain to you still is how I acquire states and how I exploit my hippocampus to actually integrate sensory and behavioral states in integrated representations. Okay, so that finishes up the adaptive layer. And then for the contextual layer, what I'm going to talk about is very specific predictions on chaining and how we have mapped that now on our understanding of the dorsal premotor cortex in monkeys performing countermanding tasks. And we can do that all tomorrow in half an hour. That's no problem.
Yeah?
All right. Excellent. I just uploaded to the wiki.
I'm not sure how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if it was online tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So
each of these layers is a very compact model within the layer.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I can. Sure.
So putting it online, you can always put it somewhere tonight, even if it's not in the permanent file.
Right.
We don't have to answer the question where it's been in there permanently.
Right.
I love that picture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it, but I have my life.
Those are the best ones.
I kind of know what some of them know.
Mm-hmm. So we're sort of about here now. Okay. Okay. That's not bad, right?
Yeah, I don't think you have to cut the curtain box. It's just sort of how you go through reacting and adapting.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, I will emphasize that tomorrow. Yeah? And I will show you some validation then of this. Key thing is basically that at this level, I'm saying we start to really integrate these sensory and these motor representations. This is another strong prediction we're making. And then we show how this all makes sense at some sort of contextual level that we then try to validate looking at the physiology of prefrontal cortex. Oh, really?
I think they do it pretty well.
All right, good.
Yeah, I really like